My name is Judy Madron, and this is a sound portrait of New Haven on the River Guest House in Stratford. The people who give it heart and soul, and the guests, some of whom return year after year to experience the comforts and pleasures of a house intimately connected to the Stratford Festival since 1953. Laura Pogson is our guide. She and her parents, Hady and Edward Smith before her, are the heart and soul. We're going to explore New Haven's life and history through Laura's eyes and her engaging ability to share stories of a home and place that has been her passion for a long time. And it's always best to begin at the beginning, when Laura and her siblings were living with their parents at 344 William Street, across from Lake Victoria in Stratford. Laura is the youngest, and she was born on New Year's Day in 1943, a girl after three boys, Harley, Brant, and Paul. And Laura and I are sitting in the living room of 344 William Street on the morning of the 17th of January, 2017, for our first conversation about the life and times of New Haven Guest House. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning, Judy.
Now, just before we began, you told me that though some people call it Lake Victoria, you call it the river. Why is that?
Correct. Because I grew up knowing it as the Avon River, we skated on it in the winter, we swam in the summer, and it was always the muddy Avon to us.
And why did it become Lake Victoria?
It was dammed, which was a very good idea, and the name came as Lake Victoria, in tradition of Stratford's Victorian heritage.
Now, this was your very first home. You were brought here after your birth at Avoncrest Hospital. What's the earliest memory that you can retrieve that comes to mind?
Well, definitely with the house, it was my desire to play in it. And my mother said, no, playing goes on outside. And indeed, when I think about the house, it doesn't have what's commonly known today as a great room or a recreation room. It was built in 1932, and in those days, children played outside. And so we had the river to roam, we had a huge backyard area to play in. There weren't any houses here. In fact, this was one of the few houses at the east end of William Street at that time.
So if it were cold and miserable, though, you'd be in your bedroom with dolls or something like that?
That is true, Judy. But I would say at that time, us children wanted to be out skating on the river or swimming in our youth. And while I did have a bedroom to myself because I was the only girl, and I could display all my toys around that room without any competition, I would say the majority of times we were outside.
Now, has the house changed much since you were small?
My parents didn't change it. It was a well-built house. The contractors say that there is a beam from the front of the house to the back in the basement. And apparently that was very unusual in the 1930s. So the house remained solid, with the floors are still level. And it's a very well-built, solid house. In 1988, when I moved in, however, I did a renovation. And I put a two-car garage at the back because we had a laneway off the side street that we could enter the back of the property. And thus, we had a greater opening to the front of the street for guests to have patio room and sitting space.
So is it still the same number of bedrooms?
No, my mother did three bedrooms and one bathroom. In those days, people didn't mind sharing a bath. But when I took over, I added a room onto the top of the garage, and I added a bathroom there. And then I was able to put a bathroom in the what was my parents' bedroom in a walk-in closet. Now, that was an unusual thing in the 30s to have a walk-in closet, but that became a private bathroom. And thus, I have three bathrooms for the four rooms.
But essentially, it still looks, when you walk in, very much like the house you grew up in.
I was very particular. And when I was choosing a contractor, I listened very carefully to find the one who would maintain that integrity of the house. I didn't want to modernize it or have it look as though there's an add-on to it. So my contractor took great pains to come through with that, and I was very appreciative as well.
So, Laura, you grew up in the 1940s. As well as you can, tell me about Stratford, the town.
Yes, the town was centered around the CNR shops. Almost everyone's dad worked at the CNR shops. And the whistle would go at 8 o'clock in the morning to summon the men. And it would go again at 1 o'clock to summon them back to work after lunch. And everyone else in town obliged that whistle. We knew we had to get off to school at that time. And men went back to work after lunch by the sound of the whistle in the town. So definitely the CNR shops were a big part of the core of the city.
And would everybody come home for lunch?
Yes. In those days, my mother cooked a full dinner at lunch. From school, we had an hour and a half in time, and my father also came home from work at lunchtime.
Now, of course, there are any number of taxi cabs and there's a bus system. How did you get around in those days?
Well, my father had a company car from Bell Telephone, and we had a family car, and I remember Mother would ask Dad at lunch whether she could have the family car for the afternoon to go out with her friends shopping in Kitchener or London. I had won a bicycle at 11 years of age at a hockey tournament in town, and so I was one of the privileged few that had a bicycle at that time. And of course, walking was the main way we moved through the town.
I was trying to find how big Stratford was in the late 40s. Do you know generally the population?
I believe the population was somewhere around 10,000 at that time. But it seemed to me that we were called a town for quite a while and then became incorporated as a city.
Would you say the main street looks very similar to what it looked like then?
Many of the buildings are still intact. And I do remember well Ellum's Restaurant, which is still the same storefront. Now, in 2017, they're trying to sell it or rent it. But as a child, I remember Ellum's. But I also remember that we went to the Jumbo Ice Cream Parlor, which is now a big apartment building called Stratford Place.
And were they jumbo servings?
I thought they were, Judy.
Yeah. And the town has always had a lot of churches, too.
Yes. Church was our main social connection. And I remember growing up in Knox Presbyterian Church. That was my family heritage of faith. And then I also went with my neighbors who were at the Baptist Church on Ontario Street. So I would go in the afternoon to their church, and then with my CGIT,
Canadian Girls
in training program, I was often in the other churches. But churches had a banquet hall usually, or a large room that we would hold events in. So the church, I would say, was the main community center.
Church was where you would make your social arrangements too,
yes.
I would guess.
And Knox Church began serving meals in 1953 in their banquet hall because we didn't have an abundance of restaurants in the town at that time. And so we served meals. My mother went every day during the festival to make the roast beef for the day. My father, who had a large garden, supplied flowers for the table. And I went to wait on the tables. The lunch was 25 cents and dinner was 50 cents.
Let's talk about your parents. And we'll start with your mother, Hady Cordry
Coughton. That's correct.
What was she like?
She was a very tall, stately woman who took a great interest in her community and her church. And I well remember that she was noted as the hat lady in town because Stratford had a renowned hat shop run by Teresa Flaherty. And Teresa would go to Toronto to select her hats and then immediately phone my mother when she arrived back to say what new hats she had in the shop. And then my mother would be at the shop and returning home always with at least one or several for the family to view and choose. Both my parents were very fashion conscious, and I do believe that was of the times. My father would go to Toronto to have Ed Provan's shop make his suits because he was a very tall man. And Ed Provan would supply the samples of fabric each season. And then mother and dad would deliberate over the samples and then make a trip one day to Toronto. And of course, in those days, it took a full day. There was no 401 highway. And they would select the fabric and have the suit measured and made.
Where was your mom born and raised, Laura?
My mother was born in Brampton, Ontario, and that was a huge flower town at the time. And she was one of nine siblings, and several of them went to work at the Dale Estate in supplying flowers for the region. And Stratford was one of them. Wade's Flowers bought from the Brampton store, and my uncle would bring the flowers up to Wade's flower shop in a van. And mother started in to be a telephone operator. And that is how she met my father, who had started with Bell and had been moved around. And of course, Brampton became one of his moves. And that is how they met.
In the office.
Yes.
And was her family from the Brampton area?
Her parents, the Coughtons, came from England. And they had two children at that time. And mother was the third child, and she was the first one born in Canada.
That makes you second generation Canadian.
Yes.
And you said she was fashionable and she loved the community. Tell me a bit more about what she loved to do herself.
She was a huge bridge player. In fact, the whole family played bridge constantly. They had many parties in this living room of bridge players, either all the women coming or couples coming. And she worked at her church in different organizations. I remember well. Every year they would have a rummage sale, and Knox Church had a huge banquet hall. So that was a big event for Stratford, this rummage sale. And then in the fall, her church group would make 400 pounds of mincemeat to sell for Christmas. And that was very significant because people love to buy the Knox Church mincemeat.
I would.
Yes.
What would you say is a significant learning from her? What did you learn?
I believe that I learned the gift of hospitality. It came naturally to me to take over the bed and breakfast. And I think it was my mother's manner of hospitality, whether it was for guests of the theater that came, or whether it was hosting my brother's teen conference people, whether it was opening the home to figure skaters, because I had been very involved with figure skating, and we often had competitions here where young skaters needed a room for the night. And I saw my mother making breakfast for the people, making dinner for them, and generally making them feel very comfortable.
I'm imagining that it made her happy too.
I saw that in my parents, that they seemed to delight in having people in the home, even though they had the three boys and me to care for.
Where did your father grow up?
My father grew up in Collingwood. And once again, his parents came out from Scotland. And he was born here. They got into Montreal, and then they just, by horse and buggy, for whatever reason, decided that north of Toronto, there was good farmland, and indeed there was. So my father grew up in the Collingwood area. And at 14 years of age, he went to the shipyard to get a job, and they wouldn't hire him because he was 14. So he went to the Bell Telephone Company and lied and said he was 16, and they hired him.
So he started at 14 and rose through the ranks by learning on the job.
That's very, very true. He told tales of traveling the roads around Collingwood in a horse and buggy, checking the Bell telephone lines, and then went off to the First World War, but he had the telegraph skills. And so he was used in France for all the telegraphs, and then, of course, returned back to Bell after the war was over.
And why did they settle in Stratford?
They had moved 11 times in 9 years of marriage. The Bell telephone moved people around much the way the banks moved people around. And he was sent to Stratford out of Toronto to open a plant here in Stratford. And he was to go back in 2 years' time to Toronto and then on to the head office in Montreal. But when he arrived here, he saw a dog chasing a cat past the Queen's Hotel on the main street. Those two were walking, and he said, "This is the town for me."
The dog was walking after the cat. So everybody gets on in Stratford.
Everybody moved at that pace at that time in Stratford. And I believe my mother and dad, who started to rent this house because they expected to move back to Toronto in 2 years, began to see the value of living here. And what happened was the man who owned the house died suddenly, and his widow came to my father and said, "Would you buy this house?" And it just came about in the right way that mother and dad felt this was a good place to raise a family. And I believe it's still that way.
And do you remember what they paid for the house?
Yes, they paid $9,000.
Which actually was quite an amount then.
Oh, I believe my father had to take out a loan with his Bell telephone shares as collateral to get that loan. We know that he paid $50 a month rent at that time.
And what would you say was his legacy for you?
My father taught me how to be wise, how to think things through, how to problem solve. I remember when I turned 16, he said, "You now must make a will and learn how to invest, because you can't expect anyone to carry you financially through life." I believe he learned that from his mother. There were six in his family, two boys and four girls. And his mother said, this during the 1800s, "My girls are not going to be domestics," because in those years, girls went out, learned how to polish silver and so on in the home. So my grandmother got all four girls out. Two went to Flint, Michigan to train as nurse. One went to the business college in Collingwood, and the fourth one became a missionary and traveled the world. Those four girls, however, did not have families and raise children. So I grew up thinking that a career for a woman was normal.
So your parents were very involved in the community before the festival began. When did they move here?
1939, okay. October 1st.
So they were here for 14 years before the festival took off.
Yes.
13 years. So I was thinking about you as the youngest, the girl, after three boys. What place did you find in the family?
I believe that I truly was spoiled. I think my brothers resented that, but I think four doting aunts really took me under their wing. They did lots of things with me. For instance, my mother would put me on the train. In those days, you could travel alone. At 6 years of age, I remember being put on the train here, my aunt picking me up in Toronto and taking me to the Santa Claus parade. And there was never a concern about a child traveling alone. There was never a concern about where we were riding our bikes all day. As long as we showed up for supper, that was fine.
So you didn't play with your brothers necessarily?
I did to a certain extent, Judy, because at the back of the house was open field. And each summer, my brothers would build huts. And they had running water to these huts. They were truly engineers. And they heated the hut with some kind of electrical heater if it was cold. And they would allow me in from time to time to visit these huts.
Now, you mentioned these four doting aunts. Were there other extended family you were close to?
Yes. My mother's family also paid a lot of visits to our house. And I remember the story of when I came home from the hospital. Baby stayed in for 2 weeks at that time. And apparently I was in the crib upstairs and my uncle drove all the way from Brampton to see me. And my mother would not allow him upstairs because he had a cold. And in those days, they thought that a baby would catch a cold. So he had to drive home without ever seeing me. So he never let her forget that story. But yes, we were quite involved with my mother's family as well.
And did you have holidays away as a family?
Yes. It was a big thing for us to go to the cottage for 2 weeks in the summer. My father worked 6 days a week at that time, but he was given 2 weeks in July. So we headed north of Owen Sound out to Big Bay, where my aunt had built a cottage, one of my mother's sisters. So it gave us time to have family visits there. And I was always allowed to take one friend.
I get the picture that your parents saw you and presumably your brothers too as individual people, not just children to be seen and not heard.
I don't think my parents took that attitude, but I remember sitting in the living room with visitors and listening to conversation. And I remember being told the story of my grandmother, my father's mother, asking her husband, my father's dad, "Why don't you talk?" And he said, "Because I learn more when I listen." And I think I took on that, where I was fascinated with listening to the life of the adults. And I remember they would talk about the stock market and something I really didn't understand at a young age.
So that has probably served you very well with all the guests who've come here. You've been very interested in listening.
I think so, because I always say that the world comes to my door. I have people who have come from New Zealand, Australia, California, South Africa, and so on. So for me, it's as interesting to have people coming to my door to tell me about their world.
Well, it sounds like it was a very comfortable place to live when you were small. You had the back opened up to fields, you had the Avon. So I want you to just think about yourself as maybe, let's say, 8 years old, so early 1950, 51. And just give me a week. Tell me about a week in your life when you were eight.
When I was 8 years old, I was going to Falstaff School. And Falstaff School was a big center of our lives as well. It has a huge playground where they have a skating rink in the wintertime. And they also had enough space for ball games on that playground. And they had a hill coming down from the school, which we tobogganed on when the principal wasn't around. And the reason we had to wait for the principal to be out of sight was he was more worried about the grass damage than he was about us having fun on toboggans. So we would toboggan all weekend long. And then on Monday morning, he would stand before each class to try and determine who was on the toboggans all weekend. And of course, none of us would tell a tale on the other. And he never did find out who it was. But Falstaff School, for sure, it was a wonderful community school. So we were down there a lot playing. So it wasn't only the back area of the house and then the front with the river where I had to play. We also played at Falstaff School.
So Sunday was church maybe once or twice?
Yes.
And a main meal, roast beef?
Definitely the roast beef was the staple Sunday dinner. And then we ate variations of the roast during the week. It would be a shepherd's pie. It would be a hot roast beef sandwich. And so on. My mother was an excellent cook, and I don't think I appreciated that until I was really grown up to know just how valuable that was to our children. And the fact that she was at home and not out working, I didn't recognize that, the value that it truly was. I remember coming home and she would be so proud of the fact that she had ironed 17 shirts that afternoon. Because in those days, the boys had to wear a shirt and a tie to school. And so she labored over these shirts. And when I think of the demanding work of housekeeping in those days compared to what we have now, it's really quite remarkable how she had time to wash all the sheets of the guests in the basement through a wringer washer.
Let's just stop for a minute and describe a wringer washer, because people don't know about those now.
Okay. A wringer washer had a huge tank for the water and hose to link up to the tap. And then above the tank were two rollers that worked on electricity, where the sheet would be placed to run through the roller to squeeze out the excess soap and water. Now that took a fair bit of time when you consider only one sheet at a time being washed. And then when I think of my mother carrying the wet laundry to the backyard to hang it out, then bringing it back down to the basement where she had what was called a glad iron. And a glad iron is a roller once again, where the sheet goes through to press it. And it was worked with the knee. You could sit in front of it and work the lever of the roller with the knee.
By pressing your knee against it back and forth. Wow.
But of course, in those days, the sheets were all cotton and had to be ironed. And then on top of that, she was going to the church to make the roast beef each day. I find that quite amazing.
Well, let's talk about the festival. The Stratford Festival opened for the first time in July 1953, when you were 10. When did you first hear about this plan to open a theater in Stratford?
My first memory is of Tom Patterson, the founder, who lived almost in the backyard of our place at the time, going to school and then becoming a journalist, and then talking with my father outside the house about an idea of an open-air theater in the park or something in the casino. Now, Tom had been given this idea by his grade 11 teacher some years earlier to come up with an economically viable project for Stratford, given that we were going to lose our railway industry. And that was a big concern as to what was going to happen to this remote town that did not have infrastructure laid to house a huge car factory or indeed any sort of multifaceted business. And so Tom would come down to the river and talk to my dad and saying that here we have the town named Stratford, streets and schools named after Shakespeare's characters. Many people think we did that afterwards, but that is not true. That was original in the building of the town. And Tom simply said, well, why don't we have a theater here the way they do in England? Now, Tom had never seen a live performance when he was envisioning this idea. He did not approach it at all from the artistic values of it, or even working in it. He simply saw it as an economic engine that could drive the city. Well, my father, who was a Bell telephone man, wires and bolts and nuts, would look at him with the greatest puzzle on his face. And I, as a child, was looking up at my father's face, not quite understanding the connection, but knowing that my father didn't think much of this idea. Well, it was so far-fetched because we were so remote. We didn't have the 401 highway. When we went as a family to Toronto, it took most of the day because we had to go Highway 7. And so my father, knowing that there was no artistic community base here at all, did not really understand it until the city council gave Tom $125 to go to New York. I think my personal view, and it is personal, was that Tom had been pestering city council for so long about this idea that they thought, let's give him the money, let's let him go to New York and see what real theater is about, and then he'll stop pestering us. Well, instead, if you have to know Tom's personality, he got in to see Sir Laurence Olivier and many others and said, well, we want to start a theater in Stratford, Canada. And of course they weren't interested. Some of them didn't even know where Canada was. But one of them said, you need to be talking to Tyrone Guthrie in England. And so Tom just phoned him up. Now, once again, you have to know Tom's personality. Nothing would have stopped Tom from phoning anybody up. And when Guthrie was on the other end of the line, he thought, if you know British hierarchy and aristocracy and all that, Guthrie thought, well, I must know this man, otherwise he wouldn't have got through to me. And Tom simply said, we want to start a theater. Would you come out? And Guthrie said, well, will somebody pay me? And Tom said, oh, yes, even though he didn't have any money behind him. But Tom had that bumblebee mentality. You know how the bumblebee should not be able to fly because of the size of his wings, but he does it anyway. So Tom hightailed it back here to Stratford and said, well, I have Sir Tyrone Guthrie coming.
Well, nobody here knew Tyrone Guthrie. So they didn't want to lose face. And so they rolled out the red carpet. And Guthrie brought his wife and Tanya Mazayevich, our first designer, with him. And they met in Dame Abel's house just over here, where my brothers used to babysit all the time. And I spent many an evening on their couch because my parents weren't going to pay for a babysitter while their boys went out and did babysitting. So I spent many a night sleeping on that couch and grew up, of course, knowing the Bells well, and Mother and Dad were there and they talked about it. And Tom said, an open-air theater in the park. And Guthrie said, no, no, my boy, the birds, you know. We'll put it in a tent. And that way, if people don't like it, we can get rid of a tent. Well, I've come to appreciate just how wise Guthrie was. He knew it would be far too risky to try to build a building. And so they brought in a tent from Chicago and its tent raiser, Skip Manley, and Oliver Gaffney, the contractor in town, began digging into the side of Queen's Park Hill. Why? Because the hill was so large that it reminded Guthrie of how the Greeks sat around the hillside watching plays in the valley. Well, all of us children on the street were mortified to see them digging our toboggan hill, and we ran home to our parents to complain. And the city told Tom, you put that hill back exactly as you found it when you're finished with this theater nonsense. Now that's the story as Tom has told it to me. Tom and I remained friends throughout all those years, and we often laughed at those early times and those early beginnings of how he was bound and determined that this festival was going to happen here.
He had an idea and he was on fire and it happened.
Yes.
Even when I was reading, they ran out of funds before they had even finished constructing the site for the tent. Mm-hmm. And a couple of donations based on faith more than anything else, right?
Exactly.
Well, let's unfold the story of your parents' part mm-hmm. in helping the festival get on its feet. Why was 344 William Street a host?
Well, when Mother and Dad were at the meeting, one of the meetings, there was concern that we didn't have enough hotels because suddenly that first year they sold out and they had no idea where they were going to put people because of our lack of accommodation. So people such as Mother and Dad, who had raised their children, that the children had moved on, simply said, well, we have some rooms, we could look after people. And once again, I believe that was Mother's fashion of hospitality. You just do it. And so in 1953, the guests started coming. Why? Because the festival also was very clever in opening up an accommodation office alongside of its ticket office. So Mother, as the years went on, would go over and buy the tickets at the same time as the people were booking accommodation. It was a great way to get the whole thing grounded and stabilized.
They'd make a phone call to your mother?
Yes.
And
so she'd put it through at the festival office. These people are coming on this particular date. So the festival would be aware of it. And then she would buy the tickets, trust that they would come. And then they would just give her the cash when they got here.
So when they started doing that, were there just a couple of you at home then still?
There was only myself. And I had to give up my bedroom because, of course, Mother needed it for guests. And it worked well because the neighbors at the time, who had an electrical store in town, went to their cottage at Bayfield for the summer. And they were happy to have me live in their house for the summer and house it, if you will. And so it was a great accommodation. I felt very grown up to be in charge of this house of the neighbors by myself.
But I think in those days we trusted young people so much more than what we do now. And I was in charge of the house, and I watched the cat and looked after that. Then I went off to do my little duty at the church, serving meals in between having fun as a child.
Do you think your parents ever questioned their decision to do it?
No. No. They felt that was the best thing that happened. My father did a 180-degree turn and believed in the festival wholeheartedly. He saw the value of it very, very early on and realized what a great asset it was for the city and how much the homes that were open were assisting in all of the things that it needed to make it work. And so I went off to work. I remember I was 14 at the time, working at the Windsor Hotel and the Queen's Hotel. Those were the two main dining areas in town. So I came experienced because I had already at 10 years of age served tables at the church. So the Queen's and the Windsor were happy to hire me.
So the festival, in fact, probably kept young people in Stratford because it offered some way of making a living.
Well, I certainly felt I was a rich woman. I can remember making tips at the work there at both those hotels and counting up one week that I had $100. Now, that was a lot of money in 53, 54, in that era, for a youngster to be making.
A 10-year-old.
Well, I was 10 when I remember coming home with 85 cents, riding my bike home, and I had 85 cents in tips in that first year. And I thought that was really an incentive. I was keen to do the job. And then when I grew older at 14 and went to the hotels, they must not have had any child labor laws working. And of course it was seasonal and casual employment. But I remember this, that I went from 85 cents to $100 in a week and thinking I was well off.
And that's why your father, when you were 16, said you have to learn how to invest.
I believe so. Yeah.
So has New Haven been hosting every year since 1953?
Yes. And of course, it would peak towards the time when Mother and Dad were aging. They were simply taking the people that had come and become almost family for them. In fact, I think sometimes those people were getting their own breakfast sort of thing as Mother and Dad were aging. But it was a really wonderful lifestyle for Mother and Dad to have those guests coming every summer, people that they'd known since the early years. And I today have a few people that came to Mother and Dad, and so they have the tales of coming to. Well, we must be clear, in the days that Mother and Dad had the house, there was no talk of a B&B. I well remember when Mother started that first year, that Tyrone Guthrie came to the front door and stood in the front door, and he was a tower of a man and a booming voice, as you could well imagine, and said to my mother, "Never refer to the people who come as tourists. They are always your theater guests. We will not be having any ye old souvenir shops here." And so today I still refer to the people who come as my theater guests. And Mother each year would say, "Well, I think they're going to be able to do the plays next year, so I presume I will be having people." And sure enough, it would happen.
Well, I'd like to talk about some of those guests. You gave me a list, and let's talk about them.
Okay.
There was the German-born Jewish stage and screen actor Frederick Vock.
Oh. Frederick
had a booming voice, and he would come in here and use that voice, and I would be somewhat intimidated by it. But I began to realize that that was important for a person on the stage. They weren't using any microphones at the theater stage, and today they've never used microphones on the main Shakespearean characters. And so, but in those days, Frederick Volk had a voice. And of course, he gave my mother, I have the book, Shylock for a Summer. It's a wonderful book. And he, of course, gave a copy to mother.
And that was the first season he, a Jewish, German-born actor, played Shylock. I had to look him up, and I found this quote. He said, when he was challenged by local journalists that as a Jew, he should feel uncomfortable playing Shylock, he replied that the assertion made no more sense than saying a Scotsman should balk at playing Macbeth, that he in fact found a strong pro-Semitic message in the play, and that he deplored that people are beset with prejudices of all sorts and can't bring themselves to wipe their eyes and read and think.
I would say, in talking and listening to him, I understood something about the Jewish faith, which I had never been exposed to before. But there again, I was doing most of the listening, and he was talking.
Now, did he come back after that first summer?
Not that I'm aware of.
Now, the next one I have here is Paul Scofield.
Oh, yes. A very tall and rather stately man, Paul Scofield was. And of course, he made a presence on our stage here. And that, I think, Judy, is what is very significant about the Stratford stage, is right from the very beginning, we were bringing in renowned actors. We were not relying on local actors at all. And I think that's what gave Stratford its strength, that we were willing to bring in people. We were a very parochial town, and the town was quite worried about these actors that were going to come and how it would change things here because, of course, we were a dry town and we went to bed at 9 o'clock and actors like to carouse after their show at night. But I think that's what strengthened it. And we accepted these renowned people when they came. James Mason came in 54. And we grew up just accepting them among us. I remember when William Shatner would eat all the time at the church. Why? Because it was a 25-cent lunch and a 50-cent dinner. And I just adored him. I mean, I thought he was the most handsome man I'd ever seen. And he would always treat me like a little kid sister when he came in. But we had this camaraderie. And it just seemed natural.
Can we explore this a bit more? You know, the description of the parochial town, how these major actors came. Was it magic that brought them? Was it that actors need to act? Was it just the time and place? What do you think? Why did that happen?
Yeah. I believe it was Tyrone Guthrie and Tanya Mazayevich. They came out of England and Europe well experienced. They knew their craft. They knew actors. They knew how to connect with them. And Guthrie was recruiting actors out of Montreal and Ottawa because those were the two main areas where acting took place. And I remember William Needles telling me the story because William Needles was on the stage at the first season. And he told me the story of going to his audition with Guthrie in Ottawa. And he said he was very nervous. And he walked in and the booming voice of Guthrie said, "Can you do what you're told, boy?" And William shook and he said, "Well, of course, of course. All right, go on, get out then and show up on first day of rehearsals." And William said, "Well, don't you want me to read something or speak something?" "No," said Guthrie. "You just do what you're told and show up on the first day." And William Needles, to the very day of his death, was always surprised about that approach of Guthrie. But that was what Guthrie wanted, was actors who could listen and be told how it was to be done. And Guthrie actually told the townspeople, you get out and raise the funds and leave us to do the artistic work. And that was very, very clever and smart.
He really knew how to go after it.
Yes.
He knew how to do that.
And that's what I think established the strength here, was that we began with such strength.
Now, another guest, guest this time, not an actor, was Dr. Wilder Penfield, who was, I found out, an American who became a Canadian. I think we've always thought he was, you know, one of us. So he came as a guest.
He did indeed. He made the journey from Montreal, and he was doing that work in neurology and making a career of his own. And he took me under his wing, and he treated me like a daughter. And I just remember all the advice he would give me about my mother aging, because, of course, that was his field. Now, I didn't really understand his entire career. But I think a story I'm about to tell you right now will explain it. After years of me starting the Bed and Breakfast, I had two couples come in from Texas and Kentucky, who both the men were neurosurgeons, and they'd been at a conference in Montreal. And of course, Dr. Penfield was a center figure in their studies and so on. And as I listened to them talking about the conference at the breakfast table, and this is one of the benefits, once again, of having the world come to my door. But when they started to talk about Wilder Penfield, I finally said to them, well, gentlemen, you would be interested to know that Wilder Penfield stayed in this house and became friends of my parents for many years. Well, they came out of their chairs. The whole place took on new meaning for them. They wanted to know which bedroom he stayed in. But then I told them my tales of Wilder Penfield, of how he gave me his book, Man and His Family. And they immediately denied. They said, oh no, it couldn't have been Wilder Penfield because he was not of that writing. He was a neurosurgeon writing medical books. So I went to my bookcase and I pulled out the book. Well, they read it, of course, that day. And they were amazed that he had written this book and had given it to me as a child.
Tell me about the book.
Man and His Family. Wilder Penfield took on a whole social attitude toward his work, that he wasn't just doing medicine on brains. He was working with people and their lives and how valuable the family was in the well-being of people. So these two neurosurgeons had their whole life opened up by this new perspective. So before they left, I went out to the secondhand bookshop and asked my friend Dee if she had any books on Wilder Penfield. Well, of course she did. So I scooped them all up and gave them to these two men as they left town. And what a delight that was to be able to share that whole story of someone who made a significant difference in the life of man in general.
Now, you mentioned Tanya Mazayevich,
yes.
But there are two other costume designers, Alicia Annis,
yes,
and Patty Doyle.
Yes. They came as guests to Mother and Dad with the Dean of Drama from the Michigan University. And they were just young students when they first came with Mother and Dad. And Dr. Halstead introduced them to Shakespeare here and to all the costume designing here. And the two of them had careers in costume designing. And Patty is in Iowa, and Alicia is in California, both retired now, but both connected back to the house. In fact, Alicia had phoned the theater to come back when she retired from costume design out of California University. And the festival placed her here, not knowing.
And when she went upstairs to her room, she had a deja vu and said, I stayed in this house, but the name of the people was Smith. And I said, yes, that was my parents. And of course we connected, and she's been coming ever since, and she's booked to come again, her and Patty. And they won't miss it. They stay about 10 nights and take in everything.
Now, Robert Miller was a friend. This is the fellow who wrote The Swans of Stratford?
Yes. And my parents played bridge with them. They were friends of that era. And Robert took on the job of being the honorary swan keeper here. So Robert and I would spend much time talking out the front of the house, as Tom Patterson did with my father. But we would be talking swans when I was talking to Robert Miller. And so I knew all the swan stories of the Stratford River. And of course, they're well told in his book as well.
And they first were raised in 1918.
Yes, the swans did not come to Stratford as a result of anything to do with Shakespeare. All of this was here. And they were icons here long before the festival came. And I well remember my mother giving me all the stale bread to take the swans to eat. Now, of course, we're told that's the worst thing you can give them is bread. But they ate plenty of bread when I was a child.
Are there any other guests that surface for you?
Yes. Several years ago, I had some people come in, California. I hadn't met them before, but they found me through friends there. And they started talking on the front patio with me about Glenn Gould. And they seemed to know quite a bit about him. So finally, once again, I said to them, well, you would be interested to know that Glenn Gould stayed in this house when he was music director here. And so we continued our conversation. And I thought, well, the least I can do is get out my books on Glenn Gould and share them with these guests, as I did. And the one gentleman, as he read, called me over. And he pointed to the book where he had it open, and it started to read as Dr. Frank Wilson, neurosurgeon. And I looked at him and I said, you are Frank Wilson. We had such a wonderful engagement talking about Glenn Gould. Why? Because he was a master of the construction of our bodies as to how we can play musical instruments. And this man, Frank Wilson, goes all over the world delivering papers to teachers and students to help them understand how best they are constructed as to whether they are best suited for a violin or a cello or a trumpet. And he is always encouraging teachers and parents to listen to the child when they're playing an instrument to see if the child is complaining about pain. Because if the child is, they're not constructed to play that instrument, and they won't go anywhere with a career, is Frank Wilson's theory. So we just had the most wonderful 4 or 5 days here.
And Glenn Gould was the guest of your parents.
Yes. Why that came about was that Louis Applebaum, who was our first music director, stayed in the house. Because, of course, as I said, in those days, they didn't have accommodation. Well, it would be expensive to stay in a hotel for any length of time. So Mother and Dad hosted Louis Applebaum. And I well remember Louis Applebaum in this living room, dancing, singing to himself. And he had a pad and pencil in his hand. He was writing the music to Midsummer Night's Dream. And that was how he did it in those days. So Louis Applebaum is well written by Walter Pittman, who did come to me to get as much information as I could help him with in writing the book.
And I did talk to Walter Pittman what it was like as a child growing up in this parochial little town before the festival came. But for me, watching Louis Applebaum in that first year, dancing alone, singing to himself in someone's living room was a strange sight indeed. And then, of course, Louis Applebaum brought Glenn Gould in, hoping that he could take on. Louis Applebaum wanted to go to the States and develop some things there. So Glenn Gould stayed for the time that he was music director here.
How long was that?
Well, he would come in for days at a time. I can remember thinking, he's staying in his room a long time. The other guests don't stay in their room. They come and chat and walk through my father's garden and have tea in the afternoon. But Glenn Gould did not do that. And he was driven back and forth when he needed to go to Toronto.
And how long was he director, music director? Just more than a summer?
Oh, yes. And definitely connected with Stratford in that we ended up with a piano that he played here. And it was recently sold to a family in Own Sound. And we all thought, well, Glenn Gould's piano should remain in town. But indeed, that was not true. The musicians here in town said, we don't really care who played that piano. We just want a piano that is in good tune.
So Glenn Gould kept to himself, is what you're saying.
You
didn't really allow people in?
And the thing that I remember was one day my father said, my father who never commented on anyone's personality, said, that is a most unusual man. And I do remember in July, the overcoat and the scarf and gloves. And I do remember him bathing his hands continually in the bathroom sink in warm water. And my mother took me to one of his concerts at the theater, and he came out and said, there will be no applause. And there again, as a young child, I thought, that is so unusual. My mother hanging on to her hands so that she wouldn't applaud, because it's the most natural thing.
So when your parents were having these fascinating guests, what were you thinking of as a career for yourself?
I wanted to be just like these actors. So I wrote a letter to Douglas Campbell, who was directing plays, and asked for an audition. My parents were mortified. They were so disgusted with me that I took the liberty to be so bold as to do that. So I never did have the audition, but Douglas and I would laugh every time he was in town about this audition that I was supposed to have and never happened. But I really wanted to be a figure skater, and I thought I could join the Ice Capades. Well, my parents did not agree with that either. That was no career for a young lady to be traveling on the road with. So that was sort of squelched as well. And in those days, women were teachers, nurses, secretaries. And my father, who had an office of about 10 secretaries, wanted me to be a secretary. And I had only to walk in there and see that office and those women typing away all day to know that was not what I wanted. And I knew I didn't want to be a nurse, and so I opted for teaching.
Did you ever think that you would be running New Haven?
That was talked about and thought about. And when my parents came to me in the 70s, and suggested that I take over the house, I did think about it. And I thought being back in the house with the guests that I remembered and the way my parents ran it would be an ideal retirement project.
But as a teenager, you probably didn't see yourself doing this.
No, definitely not. I was like most of the teens with me. We couldn't wait to get out of Stratford to get into the real world of adventure. We didn't see Stratford as being on the world stage at all.
Well, we have more to discover in future conversations. We'll leave it there and we'll move on to your part in New Haven Guest House on the River. A wonderful hour of stories. Thank you so much. And this is part one of A Sound Portrait of New Haven Guest House with Laura Pogson. I'm Judy Madron. Thanks, Laura.
Thank you, Judy.